But first, ham radio operators in the Kansas City area. Ham radio is 100 years old this year. From disasters like 9/11 to the Joplin killer tornado, from earth base to mound bounce communication, we'll look at ham radio in times of crisis and peace and explain what ham radio is doing to prepare for one more 100 years of radio transmission. And if you think this is your grandfather's radio, think again. With us to talk about it is Brian Short, who's been a ham radio operator for 27 years, and he teaches Kansas City area residents how to become ham radio operators. And Brian, so good to have you. Welcome to Up to Date.
Good morning. Great to be here.
I guess I'm not sure exactly what a ham radio operator is.
Well, hams are amateur radio operators, and just like an amateur athlete is not someone who's bad at sports, amateur radio operators aren't the bad version of commercial operators. It just means we don't get paid. We do it for the love of the sport.
And you do what with it? What does a ham radio operator do?
Well, our primary, you might have to argue that, but I would say our primary thing is that we communicate with other people. So some folks might say, well, we really focus on the gadgets. But either way, whether you are in love with technology or if you like to just talk to people for hours on end with really no big point to the conversation, just for fun, amateur radio does a lot of different things.
And do you have certain frequencies you can work with, Brian, or how does it work?
Yeah, so that's what's kind of interesting is amateur radio has frequencies all over the radio spectrum. That's one of the things that make them particularly valuable in times of emergencies. We have frequencies that will only work in a very short range, like 20 or 30 miles, and those you would use in very small close-range emergencies, somewhat like Joplin. But then you also have ice storms, hurricanes, things that are very regionalized emergencies, and you need to be able to talk thousands of miles potentially, and hams have frequencies that will reach thousands of miles as well.
I gather that lots of ham radio operators can join in those conversations. There's nothing private about this, right?
It's not private at all. It's like a giant conference call. In fact, that's one of the benefits. If you think about if you had 20 people in a room and someone had your keys in their pocket, and you were trying to figure out which one of them had your keys, and you all had cell phones, right? Suddenly, they all go outside, and now, how do we find out which person has your keys, mm-hmm. right? Well, you've got 20 phone calls to make, and no doubt it'll be the last one on the list before you get to it, right? With radio, it's a conference call, so you put out one call and say, who's got my keys? Everyone hears it simultaneously, and they respond.
Well, why not use just cell phones? What's so magic about ham radio compared to using a phone?
A couple of things. Number one is that infrastructure for phones is a little bit delicate. And of course, the phone companies are in the business to make money. So they're not building enough capacity for everyone to make a phone call all at once. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's less than 10% of the people can be on their phone all at once. So whenever some sort of large event happens, or even when you go to a stadium like the Chiefs, it's often difficult to make a call. So there's even everyday things that can keep you from being able to make a call, let alone what happens when a hurricane or tornado comes through and knocks down all the towers. And secondarily, like I said, there is a shared information aspect of that conference call, everyone listening ability that gives everyone a situational awareness that you don't reach in a one-to-one communication with a cell phone.
Yeah, there's something else, Brian, that strikes me about ham radio. There's something nostalgic may not be the right word. It's something a little bit romantic. It takes you back to another era. I came across this on a ham radio website last night. This is sort of a testimonial from Kevin O'Dell from Ardmore, Oklahoma. I don't know who he is, but he wrote this. Amateur radio is all about the magic. It's magic to talk to a complete stranger on the other side of the world while sitting in my car watching my son's football practice. It's magic to watch the eyes of a child light up when they talk to an astronaut on the International Space Station. It's magic to see the relief in a mother's face because the amateur radio operators providing communications at the county fair found her lost child. And who said magic can't be real?
That's exactly
not
right.
Bad.
And
yeah.
If you think about a little bit, go back into the history, in 1906, actually, so more than 100 years ago, there were the first voice communications. Fessenden did that on Christmas Eve way back. So, but for a long period of time, not for another 16 years, would there actually be commercial radio. So in between that time, you have tinkerers, inventors in their garages, in their barns, in their attics, working to try to perfect it. And then we actually have a local connection with that. Marshall Enzer out in Olathe back in the teens was actually teaching people radio over the radio. So somewhat similar to what we do with hamclass.org, where we're teaching people to get their license, except he had to do it by teaching them Morse code first and then sending them the textbook, basically using Morse code, and then they study the textbook. So imagine how difficult that would be. But there's definitely a huge nostalgia. A lot of the guys that I brought in, like I said, I brought in a tube here, which if you've ever seen a tube when it's in use, it glows. And a lot of guys are really attached to the glowing radio. As part of their nostalgia.
As I am, too. I can remember being a kid and getting my first radio, one of those things where you could move the needle back and forth to get different frequencies, and sitting in my home in Detroit, Michigan, and then realizing I could hear a ball game in Cleveland or in New York. I was just absolutely, and still to this day, just floored by that idea, I guess.
It is absolutely magic. And if you think of, especially, you can still do it. You can listen for what we call DXing, which is to listen to long-distance stations. Even if you just go out to your car, your AM radio at night, you can listen to Chicago radio if it's the right time of the evening. So, you know, I grew up that way as well. When I grew up, it was a little different because, you know, we had I'm about 100 miles from major metro on a farm when I grew up, and that was your only connection to the outside world. So there's a lot of magic in being able to listen to something that's far away. When you only have two or three TV channels and very few radio stations, any other outlet is kind of interesting. Now, today, I teach the class, and there's a lot of young people in the class as well. So why would a young person be interested in this? I can text anyone in the world for basically free off of my cell phone, right?
And they say that,
right? They say that. I can talk to a guy in China too. Really? Show me. And they can't, right? Because they don't know anybody in China. They don't know how to dial them. If they could figure that out, the guy wouldn't answer, or he wouldn't want to talk to some kid, right? With ham radio, you can talk all around the world. You never know who you're going to get, and that's part of the magic. But also, the person on the other end wants to have a dialogue, wants to learn about you, is interested in talking to you. It's a lot like fishing. You can, you can go buy fish sticks right now at the grocery store for 99 cents, and you got fish, no problem, and it's cheap, right? Or you can go out and spend $30 on a pole or $16,000 on a bass boat and get really involved. And what do you end up with at the end of the day? Well, you got fish you can eat, theoretically. Mm-hmm. But it's not about that, right? It's about the capture and the chase. Yeah. And you don't never know what you're going to get. And that's the magic.
You said a few minutes ago, Brian, that you teach people how to get their licenses for ham radio. Why do you need a license for ham radio?
Well, it is because there are so many. We're the largest frequency allocation behind the military. So you here on KCOR, you have 89.3 as one frequency you can use. Police departments, fire departments, really important folks like that have between 9 and 10 single frequencies that they can use. Amateur radio operators actually have huge swaths, wide ranges of frequencies that are allocated to us. So because of that, and because of international treaty agreements between other countries that says, you know, we want some qualified people to be able to do this, you have to at least take a basic license. But it's not difficult. We actually, in our class, it's just a two-Saturday class. We take you from knowing nothing, what we call zero to hero, in two Saturdays. So there's not a lot of stuff you have to know to get involved, but there are progressions. So you get your first license, and it's basically a license to learn more. And then you move up to the general class, and you know a little bit more, and you can talk longer ranges, and you have more frequency privileges. And then you move up to extra, where you're kind of the expert, and you can do even more with that.
We're visiting with Brian Short about ham radio. 100 years ago, you were saying all this began. 100 years ago, World War I began. Obviously, big connections in this town with the museum to that battle overseas. What was the involvement with ham radio in World War I? Was there any or not?
Well, actually, ham radio was forbidden during World War I.
Forbidden.
And also in World War II. And at the end of both of those wars, there was a question of whether or not they were going to allow hams to come back on the air. During that time, the thing that amateur radio benefited the U.S. and actually the whole world is a whole pool of operators. So we have all these guys out here that are already been doing their experimentation. They're fluent in Morse code. We use those in the radio core, and boom, we've got an automatic set of people we can use. And there's actually a commemoration. We have our ham radio operators are very interested in their call sign. So my call sign is, because of my initials, is KC0BS. Well, there's a call sign for the 100-year anniversary of the war, the commemoration that's going to be going on for 4 years. It's WW1 USA, and it actually is based out of the Liberty Memorial Museum.
Oh, really?
And so there'll be a lot of different events, special events, where you actually try to communicate with that station that's at Liberty Memorial, and there'll be hundreds of thousands of hams around the country trying to talk to them.
But again, it was prohibited during World War I to use ham radio.
It was. That's correct.
And why?
Well, spies, I think, okay, is probably your primary reason. They didn't want
Of course. Well, I should have thought of that.
Yeah. They don't want people, you know, passing information back and forth, even though that occurred, you know, in World War II, and the French resistance and radios were critical and a little more developed at that point. So pretty much anybody could do them with a little bit of help. In World War I, it was a little more complicated and took a lot more space.
But clearly over the years, though, Congress got warmed up to the idea of ham radio operators and the benefits they could provide, because they wound up providing this big swath of signal space for the work that you guys do. Why did they do that? What was the thinking there?
Well, you know, the first laws for radio in general started in 1917, and then the first Department of Commerce laws in 1924. And those specifically had ham radio involved, because there were so many hams out there that were actually causing interference to the commercial broadcasters. And they knew all the equipment was already out there, and that if they just said, oh, you can't use it, well, maybe they will, maybe they won't. Now we've got this huge policing effort we have to go through. Let's give them a place to go. We'll clean up the problem that way. Mm-hmm. And so at the time, they gave us what were considered to be fairly useless frequencies for commercial broadcasters, what they called shortwave. Well, it turns out shortwave is what all your police and everybody else is on at this point. So as technology has progressed, ham radio has taken the lead, using those what they thought were useless frequencies, turning them into usable frequencies and advancing the state of the art.
Brian, you got involved in this 27 years ago. What tripped your trigger? What happened in your life that brought you to ham radio?
I had my arm twisted for 17 years by my father.
Oh, really?
He had for years – I was a computer geek when I was young, and he had for years tried to collude me into getting a license by bribing me with buying an Atari 800 or a printer or whatever it was at the time that I really wanted. And finally, when I was 18, at that time, there were no cell phones. This was in about 1987. And if you wanted to talk to somebody, you would call on the phone. And it was $1.30 a minute for Kansas long distance. So as a college student going to KU, I got yelled at a few times for too many of those. I decided, well, if I want to talk to the family, this is the way to do it. And there was actually radios at the station at KU that you could use for free. So you didn't even have to buy your own radios. So my dad finally convinced me I should get my license. I got it thanks to a gentleman named Ray Pauley, my first Elmer, what we call Elmers, same as a mentor. And I got the license and I haven't stopped since. And in fact, one of my proudest achievements just occurred recently. My niece Margot just passed her test, and she was the last of the grandchildren. So all of my dad's children and grandchildren have their license, and a total of about 19 different cousins. It's very addictive, this hobby.
I was going to say it's addictive, and you know, there's this whole culture sort of wrapped around this, right? I mean, this is a real sort of family kind of deal, if I'm sensing this correctly.
That's exactly right. It's a multi-generational. It's one of those things, you know, people talk about how you can do this and spend time with your family. They were talking about that earlier, about the multi-generational aspect. Well, amateur radio is the ultimate multi-generational thing, because you get a microphone and a radio in between you, and you have no idea what the other guy looks like. In fact, you might be talking to people for 20 or 30 years on a weekly basis and never ever, not even know their last name really, just know their call sign, and you might not ever meet them. So you get, and you throw into that mix the young folks. So they don't care if you're 12 years old or if you're 92 years old. You're just somebody to talk to, and you can share whatever stories you have to share. But families make a perfect – there was actually in a recent class we had I think it was 6 grandchildren came into the class with their grandfather. And so it's a way that you can do something together. It's something to do, something to build that's interesting to young and old alike. And it's a shared hobby that is hard to beat.
And the technology, I imagine, is endlessly fascinating. There's always something new coming along. And I sense, again, that equipment and the new stuff, that's a big attraction here, right?
Absolutely. I mean, mm-hmm. at heart, all hams are really just gadget geeks, tech geeks, right?
Yeah.
So whether or not you love the very latest software-defined radio or the mesh networks they were talking about in a previous story, hams have their own wireless mesh networks and their own frequencies that are meant to be used for computer Wi-Fi. But then you also have the guys that still use the old, what we call boat anchor radios, big enough to be a boat anchor if you throw it off the side. Basically, and they preserve those and the tubes. They still use those old AM radios to talk around the country. So, you know, at the heart, it's the love of gadgets, whether it's the newest technology or keeping the old technology going.
Yeah, I want to talk to you in a minute about your involvement with the Joplin tornado, because you were down there and played a role in what happened in the aftermath of that thing. But in your own sort of career with ham radio, Brian, do you have a relationship with someone that you've maintained over the years, or do you have a story about your involvement that is, you know, one of your greatest hits in terms of how you've connected with ham radio over the years?
Well, it'd have to be Matt, and I think we're probably going to talk to Matt here a little later, but
yeah.
Matt and I met.
Matt May, right?
That's right. Matt and I met when we were putting in a repeater. So a repeater is a radio system that goes up high on a tower, and it takes a very weak signal from a small handheld type radio and retransmits it. So instead of being able to talk 2 or 3 miles like you could on a family radio that you would buy, you can talk 70, 80 miles or even across the state with some of the linking that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it takes some work to get those antennas up. And so I had reached out to the community and said, hey, I need some help down in Emporia putting the antenna up. And Matt May had done some work. He was out of Florida. He went to KU, but had spent some time in Florida. He was just back in town, and he said, "Well, I can help you out." And so we had a lot of work, and we really got along really great. And he and I started ham class back in 2006, and so mm-hmm. that's been one of my best connections in ham radio, I think.
How many kids? How many people have you taught over the years?
More than 1,100, and more than 300 of those are under the age of 16.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So. You had that number pretty handy in your head there.
Yeah, well, we're pretty proud of it. We just hit our 1,000 mark last year, and we hit 1,100 already this year. So,
just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with Brian Short, a ham radio operator for 27 years, about his involvement here and how folks can get involved and connected with ham radio. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR. You are up to date. Talk to me about Joplin a little bit. Why did you go there? What did you do when you got there, Brian?
Well, it's getting to be that time of year again, and I'll just drop the mention that, you know, a lot of guys get into ham radio because of storm spotting, right? So there's a lot of storm spotters out there, and the ham radio gives you a little bit more cachet or a little bit better credential if you're going to go do some storm spotting. It gets you in with the local guys as well. There's actually going to be some storm spotting classes in Johnson County coming up here in the next couple of weekends, and there'll be classes all over the metro. I've been active in that for a long time, but, you know, we're also interested in helping with the aftermath, because that's where the communications really fall down. In Joplin,
because the towers were wiped out by the storm.
Potentially the towers, but even in Joplin, there wasn't that much collateral damage to the communications infrastructure. The main thing was power loss, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so most of the things after about the third day go down. But there was such an influx of volunteers into Joplin that the phone systems were overloaded. So it was like 3-to-1 volunteers to regular residents. So I went down with the Salvation Army's Team Emergency Radio Network. So they go down and obviously help to feed and shelter people, and they need help with their logistics. So how do we get the messages out for who's at what shelter, who might be deceased, who's alive, getting that information back to a couple of different folks, either the mutual aid partners back in the Kansas City City area because a lot of different folks went down to Joplin, mm-hmm. or up to national resources like FEMA, letting them know the impact, getting that information about the damage assessment, getting the information about the individuals that might be harmed or might be okay, and getting that information to their family. What we call health and welfare traffic was a big effort in the first 3 days we were in Joplin.
So you felt like you made a very substantial difference.
I did. It was one of the most rewarding things that I've ever done. I mean, we were spending 12, 13-hour days and just being exhausted because you're running everywhere. And at the end of the day, you didn't want to quit because you felt like there was something else that still needed to be done. But it was very much like, strangely enough, it was a very deja vu of our public service events. So all year long during the summer, especially during the summer and spring, we have marathons, bike rides, all kinds of things where we help them with their logistics.
Let's do this. Let me bring in two other ham radios, including your buddy Matt May, into our conversation now. Carolyn Wells is a trauma nurse at Liberty Hospital. Carolyn, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning.
And Matt May, again, Brian's buddy, is an assistant director for the Johnson County Emergency Management Department. And Matt, nice to have you too.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be here.
Carolyn, how long have you been a ham radio operator?
Well, I'm the baby of the group. I've only been a ham operator for 7 years.
Okay. Matt, how about you?
I'm rolling up on my 23rd year, I believe.
So you're sort of you're a cohort of Brian's in that way, then, it sounds like.
Well, except that I've got more chronological years on him. It took me a little longer to get started. I didn't have a dad leaning over my shoulder telling me to do it. But I had the opportunity working as a volunteer for Red Cross to see how amateur radio supports those events, and that's what drove me to amateur radio.
Well, both of you guys have some very specific uses for ham radio in terms of, you know, Brian mentioned marathons and other big events in the metro. Carolyn, let's begin with you. How do you involve ham radio in some of the work that you do?
Well, what we did is we're using some federal grant funds. It became clear after Katrina that it was extremely important that hospitals have redundant communications. Mm. And so working with Matt, actually, we put together a project called KC Heart, which is Kansas City Hospital Emergency Amateur Radio Teams, to put radios in every hospital in the Kansas City metro area.
And so you did that just in case all heck breaks loose and you need a different way to communicate then.
Correct. And so that's our redundant communication. There is one hospital in every county that has HF or long distance communication capabilities. And so we practice that every month to make sure the equipment's working. We have volunteers that help us with those radios because the hospital personnel would be busy. So we do rely on the amateur radio community to help us maintain our equipment, to help us run it in the case of an emergency.
You know, Carolyn, you're sort of the newbie in the group, given the number of years, the 7 years you've been involved. Is all of this complicated stuff, or is it accessible to folks who may not be technology geeks?
Well, I call myself the poster child for amateur radio because I had no electronic experience whatsoever, and I have just really become fascinated with amateur radio. And I went on to go ahead and get my extra class license because I really wanted to teach, which is one of the things I really enjoy, amateur radio. But just working the radios, working the events, it's a wonderful way to do emergency communications, to practice all of that, and to give back to the community.
Hmm. Well, Matt May, you've mentioned there are three major scenarios for which Johnson County Emergency Management winds up using amateur radio. Tell us about them.
Sure. That's our Emergency Communication Service is the name of the group. The numbers vary, but it runs around 100 people who are on our roster at any given point. And we take that information and we use them primarily, like Brian was talking about earlier. Their first role for us is weather spotting. That's probably the thing they do the most. The second role, then, is also we use them for sheltering. So if we have multiple shelters open, again, trying to avoid, even if phone lines are all working, they tend to be overloaded. It also gives us a one-to-many distribution system to be able to talk to all those shelters. I think Brian gave the example earlier about if you have to make that phone call repeatedly, that five-minute conversation ends up taking an hour just to even get out to 6 or 8 or 10 locations. We can do it in radio in 5 minutes. So there's lots of reasons to use radio for that. And then the last one, probably the most interesting, is that our public health department has an obligation to be able to treat or provide pharmaceuticals for, should there be the entire population of the county, 550,000 plus people, should there be a biologic type event, an anthrax event, for example. That's a huge undertaking to think about doing in 72 hours, which is their obligation. So again, we're supporting anywhere between 40 and 50 dispensing sites. Again, a one-to-many distribution system, even when everything's up and running, so it's not a infrastructure-threatening type of an event.
Yeah.
But you still need radio for that. And this, it's a great way for those people as community people wanting to support the rest of their community to provide benefit.
Matt, if one of your ham radio operators spots an approaching tornado, how does that information get relayed to folks like me who I'm not a ham radio operator? Hey, how does that help me out?
Well, first and foremost is, you know, we all have awareness of there's multiple pieces to the public warning system, right? We are all familiar with our outdoor warning sirens. We're familiar with weather radio. They are the eyes and ears on the ground who are relaying, being the first what we call ground truth information collectors. National Weather Service, of course, is a key piece in all that, and they rely on amateur radio through a program called Skywarn. Well, we integrate into that. And so we make sure that our people in our county looking at in our area for events are also supporting that as well. So they're supplying the information to both. Based on that, in fact, in our county, this an amateur radio operator working with our group who's been properly trained, who's been through a certification process, based on reports that they provide, can actually prompt us to activate the sirens based on the information they've given.
Okay. Killen, we talked about hospitals and their involvement with ham radios. Tell us a bit about how amateur radio was used during Hurricane Katrina, specifically at hospitals.
During Hurricane Katrina, of course, there was a complete breakdown of all infrastructure. And one of the hospitals there, Tulane University Hospital, needed to evacuate completely. Well, they had no communications at all. And so amateur radio operators were actually very useful in contacting their home office in Tallahassee and getting helicopters to come to the hospital and evacuate all of the patients as well as all of the staff. They also helped evacuate several patients from Charity Hospital, which was right across the street. The amateur radio operators worked those radios until the very last person left. They were the last people to leave because they were providing all of that communication back and forth between the Tallahassee corporate office and the Tulane University Hospital people that were on the ground. So they were key in that evacuation. They helped coordinate the helicopters coming in and landing, and just they couldn't have done it without them.
Let me go to some phone calls here, folks who want to talk about ham radio. Let's go to Robert from Kansas City, Kansas. Robert, good morning.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge my grandfather, W6NHF. And I wanted to ask how old a kid has to be able to get into your class.
Brian, how old do you have to be?
Well, we've had successful people get their license as young as 7 years old. We have a 7-year-old girl that got her license. Now, she's not your average 7-year-old, I'll tell you that.
I was going
to
say.
You got to be able to read and do a little math. So it's up to, you know, the kids develop a little differently. So a lot of them at the age 10 are perfectly ready. A few before that, but judge by your own kid. But we welcome children into the class. It's one of our big focuses.
I just love the enthusiasm and the commitment you guys all express about ham radio. It's coming through so clearly today, and it's just amazing to me. Gary from Lee Summit. Gary, you're on Up to Date.
Yes. A quick comment. I was in Vietnam in the 60s, and I would come back from combat and throw a MARS call, and I'm not sure what MARS stands for. I could talk to my family back in the States.
Wow.
It was through a ham radio operator in Arizona.
Yeah, So what we did back at that's called a phone patch. Mm-hmm. And before satellite phones and everything else became very popular and internet, there was no way for soldiers to talk to their family at home other than by radio. So there's two options. There's the military radio, which they're busy using, or there's the ham radio. So we have a system called the Military Affiliate Radio System. That's MARS. And all it was tons of guys throughout the United States who would sit by their radio and listen on these what we call nets, which are basically meetings on the air, and they would pick up traffic for their particular city. So if somebody wanted to talk to this particular city, they would get on and they would have their radio interfaced into the phone.
Wow.
And that's why you would have to say over in the middle of that conversation so the guy could flip the switch back and forth between transmit and receive. And that way, even the local guy didn't have to pay long distance. So it was a way that soldiers could talk to their families for free.
Kellen Wells, do you have to know Morse code to be a ham radio operator?
Fortunately, now you do not. We have very many ways of doing Morse code now. There you go. I hear it.
Yeah.
We still do our call signs on the repeaters. A lot of times will be Morse code, but you do not have to have that now to pass and even get all the way up to an extra class license.
You know, we can a couple of things to end this. If people are interested, Brian, they can do what?
Easiest thing to do is go to hamclass.org. There's a couple of links that I set up right there that can get you started. Larry's List is a remailer that covers ham radio in the Kansas City area. If you're interested at all, just join Larry's List, and you can do that right there at hamclass.org. Also, we have a class coming up on this 22nd of February, the 1st of March. It only takes two Saturdays, and anyone can do it. We welcome you. You can sign up there at hamclass.org. That's the way to get started. And this is a perfect time to get started because weather season is coming up, and it's particularly interesting to go get your ham license and become a weather spotter.
And, Brian, I've got to ask, too, how did ham radio get its name? I've only seen about 19 different explanations.
Yeah,
here.
There's a lot of different stories behind that. But basically, the consistent story, although it's probably lost history that I've heard, is that a ham is an old telegrapher's term for a bad operator. Okay, so if you were ham-fisted, maybe your Morse code wasn't so good, they'd call you a ham when they were doing telegraphy over the wires. Well, that kind of took over when we got onto the airwaves. Anyone who was considered a bad operator, and it's just like Yankee Doodle, you know, the hams wore it as a feather in their cap instead of realizing that it was actually a derogatory term. So I think that's where it comes from, although we're very much more professional now.
Well, I want to thank Brian Short for his time today. I guess he's a king ham here. Thanks so much for your time today, Brian. And Carolyn Wells from Liberty Hospital and Matt May, an assistant director for Johnson County Emergency Management, thank you all for taking some time. We sure appreciate it.